This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 90th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today Matthew Green. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Gary. How are you doing?
I'm good. Matthew Green is an assistant research professor at the Johns Hopkins Information Security Institute. Matthew's research includes techniques for privacy-enhancing information storage, anonymous payment systems, and bilinear map-based crypto. Matt was a partner with Avi Rubin in Independent Security Evaluators, and he worked at AT&T Labs as a senior technical staff member from 1999 to 2003. Matt has a BA in computer science from Oberlin and a PhD in computer science from Johns Hopkins. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's good to be here.
So you spent lots of time straddling the incommensurable gap between academia and the corporate world in crypto land. So can you explain the difference between theoretical crypto and applied crypto?
Well, there are a lot of differences. I mean, it turns out, and I was surprised by this, but a lot of people who do applied crypto, meaning they write software and they do things with crypto in the real world, don't seem to like theory very much. And surprisingly, it goes the other way, too. It's not so much a question of like, but a lot of the kind of academic cryptography researchers don't spend a lot of time, you know, up to their elbows in code. And that gap has started to be kind of a problem, I think, for the software world.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think there's a range even in academia from like financial crypto to S&P to Usenix and so on. And there's also a range in corporate land thinking the difference between, say, cryptography research and, you know, to ISE and Cigital. So, and there aren't many people who can do that. Ari Jules was one, and he just got laid off from RSA.
Well, let me put it a different way. Maybe it's that there are a lot of people who could do a lot more than that, so they go off and they do more interesting things. So maybe it's not quite as bad as it seems. So, but yeah, no, definitely there were a few people who were really experts in it, a few people who are experts, and Ari was one of them, and now he's no longer, at least at RSA, he'll keep doing something.
I'm sure he will, yeah. How do you suppose if you're in academia and you're learning about crypto and it's exciting and maybe you publish some stuff, you want to become more of a practical person in applied crypto? How do you make that change?
Well, I mean, you're out there, you're doing things. The thing that I would advise you to do is go start looking at real systems. There are tons out there. There's tons of code out there, open source code you could look at. There are protocols out there that are major protocols we use for all kinds of stuff, and yet nobody, has academically really poked at them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have just this kind of wealth of stuff that you can do, and you can get it published, too, so start doing it.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. Actually, that's how we got started back in the day with the Java security stuff in the mid-90s.
Yep.
I'm dating myself. I better be quiet. So your blog, cryptographyengineering.com, made a huge splash recently when you got a takedown request from a seriously misguided dean. Let's talk about the controversy first and then the actual content, which is more important, because sure. For the record, Silver Bullet wants to avoid the Snowden effect and talk about the real tech stuff. But we have to talk about the controversy.
I'll give you the quick story. There's actually not much to tell. I wrote a blog post. It was so let me give you the 2 second background. I was contacted by a reporter a few weeks back. This reporter was from ProPublica. He had some background questions about encryption to ask me. I spent a lot of time thinking, wow, this guy seems really convinced that the NSA is spying on us all. I hope he doesn't write an article saying that I'm the one who's saying all this stuff.
Right.
I tried to be very careful. And then one day I look at the New York Times, and there's this huge article about how the NSA is spying on us all, and specifically how they're breaking all of our cryptography by inserting back, bad standards and putting backdoors into products, and it was all well-sourced and amazing. So I wrote a blog post kind of fleshing out what was in there, making clear I'd never seen any classified documents.
It was a thing called On the NSA, in case you want to go see it.
Yep, it's up there. It's blog.cryptographyengineering.com. The post was just, let's put some meat on these bones. We don't know too much yet. Let's try to speculate. That's all it was.
Mm-hmm.
I linked to the New York Times article. I think I grabbed an image off of the Guardian newspaper, and that was it. So I had this post up there, and then a week or so later, I get an email from my dean saying, well, we think that you need to take this down right away. There's been a report that you're hosting classified material and using the NSA logo improperly.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote to my colleague, who you mentioned before, Avi Rubin. I said, there's no way I'm taking this down. But what are we going to do?
Well, I saw when it hit Twitter, we were all just like, uh-oh, here it comes. Andrew Douglas doesn't know what he's gotten himself into.
Well, I didn't know it was going to turn out the way it did. Yeah. I mean, I was assuming that a few nerds, you know, like me, would get upset about it, but a bunch of other people did too. And so it became a huge deal.
Well, it became a huge deal because, you know, we have First Amendment rights, plus you were just pointing at the stuff that was theoretically classified.
Right.
And this notion of a chilling effect, you know, caused by people that just sort of look your way, I think that's very disturbing and concerning, especially when it gets all the way to academia.
Well, I got to be honest, I really did spend a day thinking I was going to lose my job, which is liberating because I got to, you know, have lunch with my grad students and be pretty relaxed about it. But it was a scary time. And it has made me think twice about some of the things I do and I say now.
Right, right. I guess that's all part of growing up.
Yeah,
I suppose.
Unfortunately.
So we do have to put this in perspective, right? So if you think about the early crypto days with the wars when cryptography was treated as a munition and everything was, you know, supposed to be under wraps, this is a pretty minor dust-up compared to that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's interesting because once upon a time we had this crypto war where everything was going to either have a government-mandated backdoor in it or we weren't going to be allowed to use crypto at all.
Right.
We won that war. We won that war.
So we thought we did.
We thought we won that war. And again, this is also a lot of it's before my time, but not yours. So we won that war.
Go ahead, rub it in. It's fine. We don't mind.
No. Actually, I was paying very close attention even though I was a bit younger, but mm-hmm. so we had this this fight, and we thought we won. And it turns out what we learned recently is that the fight was never won; it just went underground. And the consequences for us have been almost the same, except that now we don't even have the kind of public policy option to object
right.
to what's going on.
Right, right. So we do have to be very cognizant of that chilling effect, and we have to jump on it when we see things happen like this takedown of a blog thing. Because it's, you know, it's our liberty at stake here. So let's talk about the content. Bull Run. So according to the Snowden leaks published by Ars Technica and the New York Times and others, the NSA has been doing a whole bunch of things. Tampering with NIST standards, weakening protocols, weakening RNG implementations in hardware and software, bugging Skype, snagging and breaking crypto keys, infiltrating telecom companies, and decrypting SSL connections.
That's a long list.
That's a long list. So what are your thoughts about these activities as a cryptographer, a practicing cryptographer? What's the deal?
Well, I mean, it's like being a doctor and finding out that somebody has been sneaking into your, you know, blood supply at night and tampering with it. It's that bad. You're you know, maybe it's not that bad. Maybe I'm being too dramatic, but it's how I feel. I feel like we're out there trying to build systems that are secure, and it's really, really, really hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then meanwhile, you add to that really almost impossible equation, you have this person actively trying to sabotage you. And in that world, it's just hard to get anything right. We can't trust anything.
Right.
And, you know, maybe that's okay. Maybe we are okay with living in a world where the NSA can spy on us. And maybe the NSA is not the adversary most people care about, but it's still upsetting because we don't know what's good anymore. We don't know if it's just the NSA or if their weaknesses are exploitable by other people.
Yeah. So, let me take a slightly different angle. So we all know that stuff is pretty broken anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to tell the stuff that's broken from the stuff that isn't broken from a security engineering perspective. Even when you don't have somebody intentionally trying to break the design while you're designing it.
Exactly. Exactly. Imagine that. Imagine somebody's coming onto your system. It's already riddled with bugs and adding new ones.
Fantastic. So yep. In the blog post, you point out that, quote, software is a disaster. Do you think we're getting any better at software security on the planet or not?
Well, we're getting better at software security. I mean, in part, thanks to people like you. But unfortunately, I don't think that kind of improvement, it translates equally to all areas. So I know that, you know, if you go to financial institutions, you go to people who are really willing to spend money on security, mm-hmm. yes, you're getting better software.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is there's a lot of software out there that we still really depend on, things like OpenSSL, things like, you know, even the Apache web server and the Linux kernel that I don't think are getting as much of that kind of attention right now.
Yeah, there was this notion that mini eyeballs was going to magically solve that problem, but it was very naive, I think.
I don't think there are many eyeballs who have the kind of skill it takes to find these subtle bugs.
Yep. And economics dictates that those who do have such eyeballs tend to be expensive.
They're expensive, and apparently, we learned recently, some of them are actively working for the other side. So how do you fight that?
I don't know. Right. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So here's the, you know, the $21,000 question, or maybe it's $2.1 billion question now. What should companies and individuals do about this?
Well, I mean, so there's a whole bunch of stuff. I think that right now we're in that kind of, we're in the phase where the goal is to diagnose the disease and try to figure out how bad it is. Mm-hmm. And I really call it the disease because I think what's happening, this adding back doors to commercial software, breaking standard stuff. I think that crossed a line. Mm-hmm. In terms of what the government has plenty of perfectly good reasons for intercepting communications. I'm willing to accept that we need an NSA. Where I think we should draw the line is in this kind of breaking security that could also make us less secure as well.
Right.
And so I think our first task as academics and as security people is to go out and try to figure out where the problems are. Mm-hmm. We had a big lesson in that just yesterday and the day before when we found out that RSA, for example, RSA, which is a division of EMC, was one of the companies that included what is widely believed to be a backdoor random number generator in their BSafe cryptography toolkit.
Right. I wanted to talk to you about that. Let's just go ahead and chat about that for a minute. So what is your view on the RSA BSafe default RNG problem, and how does this impact applied cryptography? I mean, we tell people not to roll their own crypto all the time, and then here we are putting disastrous chemical waste directly into the standard.
The random number generator was proposed by NIST. It was supposed to be the secure government-approved RNG. What we believe is it has a backdoor in it, and it's now gotten to the point where maybe it even goes on beyond belief. We have every reason to believe it has a backdoor in it, mm-hmm. so people can figure out random numbers. There is no reason in the universe to put this thing into a product as a default. I have been over it 1,000 times and trying to find some reason why anyone would make that decision. It's slow, it eats your system performance, it's biased, it produces bad random numbers, and it's been known for a number of years that it may have a backdoor.
Hey, listen, will you clear up for our listeners who are not cryptographically inclined what the difference is between something that's a good random number generator from a Monte Carlo perspective versus a good random number generator from a cryptographic perspective, because those are completely different things.
Sure. So, there's this notion that you need random numbers for lots of things. If you're doing statistical simulations, you need random looking numbers, and so there are algorithms for doing that. But when you're talking about cryptography, you need something stronger. You need to know that nobody, no adversary is going to be able to predict the next random number that comes out of the thing. And so to achieve that, we use a whole bunch of different tools. One of the things we use is something called a pseudo random number generator, which is based on typically kind of cryptographic components like AES or the SHA hash function. Mm-hmm. And those are the common types of random number generators we use because we trust those functions. What was different about this one is it was based on elliptic curve cryptography.
Yep, which was all the rage back then.
It was all the rage, but in this case, what's nice from the NSA's point of view about elliptic curve cryptography is it makes it fairly easy to hide a backdoor. You could have a kind of a public key that's in the RNG, and somebody else can know the secret key. Mm-hmm. And using that secret key, they can actually predict, unlike the way random number generators are supposed to work, the person who has that secret key can predict the next bits that are going to come out of it. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that's disastrous for crypto.
Mm-hmm. So if you use RSA BSafe in your products and you've linked in that bad random number generator, it's time to go fix your stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's the default. So if you use BeSafe and you didn't go out of your way to make it not the one you're using, then yeah, it's time to go replace your stuff.
Yep. So back to the, let's pop back to the thing before on the stack. So what should companies do about this? I mean, we just said if you're using that thing, go fix it. But what about individuals? What about corporations that are counting on crypto to be done properly by the people they're buying it from? Should we tell people now, well, I guess you should roll your own? Because they're going to screw that up even worse.
No, I mean, that's a terrible idea. I think we should try to get people using standard open source. Open source is a big part of the answer to this. We have to start using open source. The idea that you could sneak a backdoor into a widely used commercial closed source library, I mean, that can only happen in a closed source library. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to get rid of it. It wasn't snuck in. It was published that it was there, but nobody much paid attention to that. Mm-hmm. We have to have more open source, more widely studied libraries like that. But even that's not the ultimate answer, because you can do things to open source software as well.
Yep.
But
we need to get OpenSSL is kind of a platypus, as you point out on the blog properly.
Yeah. OpenSSL is terrible. It's just awful, messy code. Awful. Awful. Truly, truly hot, shimmering.
but we all use it.
We all use it because it's the best thing out there, which is sad.
Right.
But this is exactly the point, is that I think that over the last few years, there's been kind of a bit of negligence, partly from the research community and partly from the kind of industry, about replacing these not very well-supported tools and doing things right. We've just said, okay, it works well enough. Let's patch it and keep moving. I think there needs to be a big investment now in looking at all our standards and looking at all our code and seeing what we need to redo.
Mm-hmm. So I have a personal question for you, but we'll do it right here recorded for 10,000 people. So I've been using S/MIME for a few years after I ditched PGP mail stuff. Is that dumb?
So wait, doesn't S/MIME, don't the CAs generate your secret key for you?
They can. You can have a self-generated and self-signed one, or you can get one from a CA, which maybe I did.
Well, aside from then you should probably think about that. Aside from the fact that somebody else you don't trust generates your secret key from you, I'm not aware of any huge bugs in S/MIME, but it's been a while since I looked at it.
Okay, probably better than nothing.
Yeah, definitely better than nothing.
All right, so now let's get to the philosophical heart of this matter. I think that we have a pretty serious problem in the government's approach to cybersecurity, because the NSA, by their very mission, is supposed to spy. Let's just ignore the for us and not on us part for a sec. But we also somehow put them in charge of defense.
Yes.
Right? And so it's like we didn't learn any lessons from the Cold War and the what we call the Chinese Wall between the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense when it came to nuclear weapons. All that stuff that the people that set up that system knew from a policy perspective got ignored when it came to cyber. So what are we supposed to do about that?
You know, I don't know. We have NIST. NIST is the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, and their job is to produce these standards that we use for crypto. But they're mandated by law to work with the NSA, and the NSA has a lot of the brains and a lot of the computer power mm-hmm. that's supposed to be deployed in, you know, in fact, the NSA's mission is to secure our computing systems. Part of it is, anyway. But the problem is NIST doesn't have the resources to look at SHA-3 or AES all by themselves. They need that help,
right.
And they're required to have that help. The problem now is we just don't know, and I don't think we will ever be able to know that the NSA is definitely working in our defense and not against us. I don't know a solution to that problem.
Well, I mean, the problem is that from a policy perspective, we're asking them to work at cross purposes. I mean, we're putting them in a conflict on purpose. Right. So, hey, please go out and spy. But by the way, could you just shoot off your left foot when it comes to spying, please?
Exactly. Now, you'd think that somebody there, somebody at the NSA would have said, hey, this could blow back at us and could hurt us all. Somebody didn't make that calculation. I guess they thought there would never be a Snowden. But there has been, and now we're dealing with the consequences.
Mm-hmm. So how do we manage to get the government some sort of a clue about security engineering? You know, they're sort of, if you listen to the contractors and the ads and you read the Washington Post, like all the coverage is about just network security stuff, like some kid watching a screen or clean up on aisle 7 security, but there's really not anything about security engineering that I can find.
Yeah, no, it's hard. I don't know. I don't even know how to approach that problem.
We need your help, Matthew. Come on. What are the answers?
Oh, seriously, ask somebody else. No, it's we don't know how to build secure systems. I mean, a few people have started to make progress in it and train other people on how to do it. But I feel like until we come up with an entirely new approach to building software, at least, at a minimum, we're just not going to ever really, we're going to have a few systems that are more secure than others, but we're never really going to solve the problem.
I think we've been making some progress, just for the record. But there's some things that remain extremely hard. Like,
yep.
We've been working on architecture risk analysis at Sigital for approximately 15 years. And I know you guys did some of this at Independent Security Evaluators.
Sure. Yep.
So did you have a standard approach? Did you figure out a way to teach this? Do you think you can teach it in school now that you're a research professor?
See, the problem is that I think you can teach a lot of people. I think what you guys are doing, you know, we would look at products and we would find problems and we would patch them. And I think that's a good thing. But, you know, we were always kind of trying to mop up the ocean because we were working with good companies and we were making good progress with them. But for every company we work with, there are 20 or 100 that we weren't working with. Mm-hmm. So you guys have at least an approach that is more scalable. You're trying to train people to write code and you're writing tools to help people write code. I think that's definitely a start. But I still think that ultimately we're just reducing the number of bugs, not eliminating them.
Mm-hmm.
And until we figure out how to write software that really can't be exploited, unfortunately, I don't know how to do that, but unfortunately, I think we're going to be at risk.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll always be at risk, but I think that we've made progress on two fronts and not so much progress on the third front. The two fronts are code review because of static analysis and because of the very nature of the way source code compiles and so on. We've made a lot of progress there. We've made some limited progress on architecture risk analysis that we were just talking about. The idea of looking at design for flaws as opposed to bugs. But when it comes to pen testing, it seems like we're doing pretty much the same stuff we've always been doing.
Yep. Yep. Poking some holes, finding some bugs, patching the bugs.
Yeah. And yeah. You know, late in the life cycle usually, so it turns out to be expensive to fix once you poke a hole.
Exactly.
However, all three of those things, they make up a pretty reasonable approach to security engineering.
They do.
What are you guys in academia doing to create people who can do those three activities?
Well, when it comes to software, again, software is not, fortunately, is not my specialty. I get to work in the areas that are just hard, not impossible. So, you know, when it comes to software, you know, we had a lot of really promising work going on, I think, up until recently, where the goal was to build programs where we could actually try to assert that the program could not be exploited.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was pushing hard towards that. And I think what people have realized is that's just too hard a problem. So everybody has kind of moved on to, maybe I won't say everybody's moved on, but a lot of the recent work has moved on to simpler problems, which is trying to detect exploits, trying to find kind of ongoing, you know, attacks on systems,
mm-hmm.
on software systems. And I think that's all promising work too. But it's kind of depressing to me to see that, you know, there's nobody out there. There's no, you know, Alan Turing out there coming up with the future of how to make software secure. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah, so I guess that would be, for example, working on a programming language that has better security properties than the ones that we use now.
Yeah, or programs where you can provably, you can prove that they always act within certain parameters.
Uh-huh.
We just don't know how to do that.
How about this for theory? So I've challenged a bunch of academics to think about this, but they're always going, oh, that sounds hard. So... You know, we spend all our time in computer science theory trying to build universal Turing machines,
right?
And talking about what's computable and what's not. And yet there are all these things way down at the other end of the Chomsky language hierarchy that could do a lot less by their very mathematical mm-hmm. nature. Why not figure out what we can do with those things to avoid security problems?
Well, no, I mean, I agree that trying to bite off more specific problems that we can actually make some progress on is a big, big part of this. But then again, I think you do have people who try that approach and then they run into the wall of, well, nobody will use it.
Yeah.
Right? There are these people out there building these strongly typed verifiable programming languages. Do you want to write software in this language? I don't.
It's more fun to have the power of assembly language on steroids, which is C.
Exactly. Well, which everybody knows and you can get people to write for cheap.
Right. Oh, well, gosh. I guess we've reached the end of our rope. So I have one totally off the wall last question, and it's actually the last question that I asked Avi the first time he was on Silver Bullet. I think that was 87 episodes ago in episode three. So what is your favorite breakfast cereal?
I really, really always love the Cap'n Crunch or the Crunch Berries.
Wow.
And you're terrible for you,
but still allowed to eat that?
No, not at all. I think I'm going to let my kids go near it.
You heard it here first. Thanks for your time today, Matt.
All right. Take care, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The July-August issue of IEEE S&P includes a Silver Bullet interview with Visa CSO Gary Warzala and features articles from Fred Schneider, Dan Gere, and Becky Bass, among others. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.